So this is the 39th sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, which is the Maha Asapura Sutta. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living in the Angan country at a town of the Angans named Asapura, from which the discourse gets its name. There the Blessed One, the term for the Buddha, addressed the monks thus, "Monks, Venerable Sir," they replied, and the Buddha said this, "Recluses, recluses, bhikkhus, that is how people perceive you." And the word is like samana. Samana is the word here, which is rendered as recluses. And you know that word these days. It's where we get the word shaman from. And when you were asked, "What are you?" you claim that you are samana. Since that is what you are designated and what you claim to be, you should train us. We will undertake and practice those things that make one a samana, that make one a Brahmin, which was another term of high regard in those days, so that our designation may be true and our claims genuine. In other words, so that we are who we say we are. And so that the services of those whose robes, arms, food, resting place, and medicinal requisites we use shall bring them great fruit and benefit. In other words, for the monks and the nuns, the people who support you with the four requisites, and there they are, the food, shelter or resting place, medicines and robes, those four resources or the four basic requisites for a renunciant, so that people who offer those things to you will get lots of good karma back because you're a good monk or nun. And that our own going forth as monks and nuns shall not be in vain, but fruitful and fertile. So conduct a livelihood, the things which make one worthy of the term samana. And what, monks, are the things that make one a samana, that make one a Brahmin? Monks, I would say here nuns, you should train us. We will be possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing. These are the two guardians of the world, Hiri and Otapa. Shame means that you feel remorse, a sense of I shouldn't have done that, the conscience which human beings have, and a fear of wrongdoing is understanding the karmic consequences of bad behavior. So those two things keep one on the moral, virtuous path. Now, monks, you may think thus, we are possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing. That much is enough. That much has been done. The goal of recluseship has been reached. There is nothing more for us to do. And you may rest content with that much. Monks, I inform you, I declare to you, you who seek the status of samana, please do not fall short of the goal of being a samana while there is more to be done. And what more is to be done? Monks, nuns, you should train thus. Our bodily conduct shall be purified, clear and open, so you're not hiding things from people, flawless and restrained, and we will not praise ourselves and disparage others on account of that purified bodily conduct. And there's a beautiful sayings here. It's purified, but not just what you show to other people, what's in private. And as you all know, that we try allow all visitors to our monasteries twice a year to go into any hut and find out how the monks that you feed, that you support, actually live. So certainly my room is open to you. Actually, most of the year it's open. So you can go in there and rummage around and see what's in the drawers, under the bed, behind the toilet seat or whatever, to make sure that I am living an appropriate life. So it's open. And just because it's clear, open, flawless, and restrained. On that account, you should not praise yourself and disparage others. You don't say, look at those other scallywag monks in that other monastery. They're not as good as us. If you are doing that, that's not pure conduct. Now, monks, you may think thus. We are possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing, and our bodily conduct has been purified. That much is enough. That much has been done. The goal of being a summoner has been reached. There is nothing more for us to do. And you may rest content with that much. Monks, nuns, I inform you, I declare to you, you who seek the status of summoner, do not fall short of the goal of rectorship while there is more to be done. What more is to be done? Monks, nuns, you should train yourself thus. Our verbal conduct shall be purified, clear and open, flawless and restrained, and we will not praise ourselves and disparage others on account of that purified verbal conduct. And again, it's not just speaking nicely and kindly to people in public, but also in private as well. We speak nice things about each other. You know, when we go back to the monastery, we don't go around and say, yeah, I mean, that Jacob Medin, oh, you know, is we don't say anything like that. What we say to you in front of your face, Jacob, is how we talk about you behind your back as well. So, you know, we've got to be clear and open. And again, just because we think, yeah, our body speech is good, we do not praise ourselves and disparage others on account of that purified verbal conduct. Again, monks, you may think, we are possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing. Bodily conduct has been purified, and our verbal conduct has been purified. That much is enough, and you may rest content with that much. Monks, nuns, I inform you, I declare to you, you who seek the status of a summoner, do not fall short of the goal of rectorships while there is more to be done. What more is to be done? Monks, you should train thus. Our mental conduct shall be purified, clear and open, flawless and restrained, and we will not praise ourselves and disparage others on account of that purified mental conduct. Now, it's a bit hard to know what it means by open mental conduct, but there are two things, even said by the suttas. There's your body language, so people can tell what you're thinking just by the way that you're sitting, the way the expression's on your face. And secondly, obviously, that some people can read your mind, so be careful. It may be open without you knowing. So flawless and restrained, and even though you have got good mental conduct, you know, you don't hold on to bad things of the past. You don't sort of have negativity inside. You should not praise yourself and disparage others on account of that purified mental conduct. Now, monks, you may think thus. We are possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing. Our bodily conduct and verbal conduct has been purified. Our mental conduct has been purified. That much is enough, and you may rest content with that much. Monks, I inform you, I declare to you, you who seek the status of a summoner, do not fall short of the goal of rectorships while there is more to be done. And what more is to be done? Monks, you should train thus. Our livelihood shall be purified, clear and open, flawless and restrained, and we will not praise ourselves and disparage others on account of that purified livelihood. Now, monks, you may think thus. We are possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing. Our bodily conduct, verbal conduct, and mental conduct have been purified, and our livelihood has been purified. That much is enough. And you may rest content with that much. Monks, nuns, I inform you, I declare to you, you who seek the requisite status, do not fall short of the goal of rectorship while there is still more to be done. So I'm going to pause now, just sum up, and see if there's any questions. And this is the way I'm going to be doing this sutta today. So you can see here that the Buddha is saying, now, if you're, a monk or a nun, a bhikkhu, a bhikkhuni, a samana, you should live up to that designation. In other words, if people are going to call you that, you should deserve that name. And to be able to do that, you have to be possessed of fear and shame of wrongdoing, keep good bodily, verbal, mental conduct, and right livelihood. We won't go into right livelihood here because that's a whole different subject. And even if you have all of those three things in line, you should never praise yourself and disparage others. That's a constant refrain throughout the whole sutta. The idea which I've mentioned before of spiritual materialism or holier than now has no part in Buddhist practice at all. Even if you're enlightened, you don't tell anybody, you don't think, look at me, I can get into jhana, but you scallywag over there, you can't even sort of keep on your breath for 2 minutes without wandering off. That is not the way of a Buddha. That's not the way of a monk or a nun. We should never disparage others or praise ourselves on account of any attainments or any progress. So if you're having coffee with someone and you start talking about, oh, I keep 8 precepts every month, what about you? And they say, no, I'm only up to 5 precepts. Oh, you're hopeless. I'm much better than you are. Then they're not a Buddhist. So you should never praise yourself and disparage others. Any questions? Good. We carry on. Restraint of the senses. What more is to be done? Monks, nuns, you should train us. We will guard the doors of our sense faculties. On seeing a form with the eye, we will not grasp at its signs and features, since if we left the eye faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade us. We will practice a way of its restraint. We will guard the eye faculty. We will undertake the restraint of the eye faculty. So you go in the shops and you see something you really, really, really want. Then that's when you haven't guarded your sense faculties. So now you're grasping at the signs and the features, you know, the packaging of the stuff which you want to buy, which you don't need. But you can see just when your sense faculties aren't guarded, it's so easy to get sort of desire. And the grief, if you can't get it, somebody else gets it before you, blah, blah, blah. On hearing a sound with the ear, on smelling an odor with the nose, on tasting a flavor with the tongue, on touching a tangible with the body, on cognizing a mind object with the mind. The 6 senses, and the 6 sense bases and the 6 sense objects. So the sense restraint means whatever you see, hear, smell, taste, touch, or cognize with the mind, you don't grasp at just some of its signs and some of its features. In a way which gives rise to covetousness or its opposite, ill will. So you see your enemy coming down the road. And your mind, your eyes, your ears, you don't grasp at those features which will justify or increase your ill will towards them. You restrain the senses, and so you send your senses to something about them which will overcome the ill will towards your enemy. You train your senses to see the other part of them. You don't grasp the signs and features which will just feed in to your negativity. In the same way, especially as a monk or a nun, we see a member of the opposite gender, very attractive. We don't go to that part of their body which is going to, that grasp those signs and features which are going to encourage more covetousness or lust. We go to the other part of them. I've sat here before and told one of my tricks in the early days when I was a young monk, young, fit, attractive, maybe, I don't know. But anyhow, you see a beautiful girl come into the monastery, and instead of going to, you know, the part which attracted a man, I'd always look for her pimple. I'd look at her face, and there was always a pimple somewhere. And so I grasp at the pimples rather than the beautiful hair or the breasts or whatever else turned a person on. And that was wonderful for me because that meant I wasn't grasping at the signs and features which would create more lust or desire. I was grasping at those other things which would actually give me a more quiet and peaceful perception of that person. So that's what it actually means. It gives you an example of what we mean by sense restraint. You're breaking the rules. Oh, actually, you came in late. Because this is a long sutta, I made a rule that no questions until I finish a section, and then I can ask. Otherwise, we'll be here for a long time. But it's coming up at the end of sense retreat, and then I can ask for questions. It's almost there. Just one moment. Restraint the mind. Now, monks, you may think thus. We are possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing. Our bodily conduct, verbal conduct, mental conduct, and livelihood have been purified, and we guard the door of our sense faculties. That much is enough. And you may rest content with that much. But, monks, I inform you, I declare to you, you who seek the status or deserve the status of samana, don't fall short of the goal of recluseship while there is still more to be done. So, again, the refrain, yeah, it's marvelous you've got sense restraint. Number one, don't praise yourself and disparage those other people who haven't got sense restraint. And don't stop there. There's more to be done. Yes, questions, Rodney?
Yeah,
Yeah. Yep. Yes, you are saying, for the sake of the talk, that some people interpret sense restraint as they just look 3 feet in front of them on the floor. They never look left and right. They never look into people or do anything, and they appear like zombies. You know, it seems to be taking it to an extreme, you say. And I always go back to the story of my teacher, Ajahn Chah, who said when he was a young novice, maybe about 17 or 18, you know, full of the forces of puberty, for 3 months, he said, during the retreat period, he made a very strong resolution. He would not look at any female. And he had enough will and control. He actually did that. For 3 months, he never actually looked at a girl. Maybe saw them and put his head away straight away. And after the 3 months, he said, once his determination was over, the first woman he looked at, his mind got blown all over the place. And he realized, and he told us that that's not the way to practice sense restraint. He said, no, that doesn't work. That's, you know, that's too much, you know, what is it, that the three monkeys, seeing no evil, hearing no evil, speaking no evil. And if you want to do that type of restraint, you get reborn as a monkey in your next life. No, you don't. That's only a joke. But you have to be much more nuanced than, again, like looking like a zombie. So in other words, you see something or some person or something you want. And it's as if the mind says, why do I want that? Look for something which takes away that wanting, that covetousness. You see, look at something which really upsets you. Like a sound, someone says, you know, you're an idiot for asking such a stupid question like that, Rodney. Then you think, whoa, what do you mean by that? Now, you don't look at the words in that way. You can look at another part of the words. In other words, you don't grasp those details, those features, which are going to encourage, you know, the greed and hatred. That's sense restraint. So it's not just, you know, closing your eyes and, you know, putting earplugs in your ears. Otherwise, if that was the case, you know, deaf, dumb, and mute people would be enlightened a long time ago. So thank you for that question. Yes. I hear what you're saying. Yes, you're saying the mental part of sense restraint is the biggest, the major, and of course that is. That mind controls all the other senses and directs you to see here or to see there. So that mental training is important. It is the most important. The mind is pure, the other senses come into line. Okay, I've got to go on because it's a long sutta. Now the moderation in eating. And I'll go to wakefulness, mindfulness, and full awareness before we actually ask for questions. What more is to be done? Monks nudge, you should train us. We'll be moderate in eating. What does it mean by moderate in eating? It doesn't mean just going without food. It doesn't mean pigging out on one meal a day. What it means is this. Reflecting wisely, we will take food neither for amusement nor for intoxication, not just for pleasure, nor for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the endurance and continuance of this body, for ending discomfort and for assisting with the holy life. Considering, thus I shall end all feelings, usually of hunger, without arousing new feelings of overeating, and I shall be healthy and blameless and shall live in comfort. So that's a refrain which we reflect on before we eat. And I usually, if that's my reflection, I say to myself, you know, in the minutes before I eat my food. So I remember the purpose. It's not for beauty and attractiveness. It's not for pleasure, although I did understand some years ago that you have to enjoy your food, otherwise you don't digest it properly. I've found that out by eating for 9 years food, which I didn't like, and messing up my digestion. And so, but not for intoxication, not just for having a good time, just so that you can end the discomfort of hunger and without having the feelings of overeating, so that you can live the holy life, have lots of energy, good health to meditate. Now, monks, nuns, you may think we are possessed of shame, fear of wrongdoing, our bodily, verbal, mental conduct and livelihood have been purified, we guard the door of our sense faculties, we are moderate eating. In eating, that much is enough. And you may rest content with that much. Monks, I inform you, I declare to you, you who seek the recluse's status, the status of a samana, do not fall short of the goal of recluseship while there is still more to be done. What more is to be done? Monks, nuns, you should train thus. We will be devoted to wakefulness during the day while walking back and forth and sitting. You see this walking back and forth, that's the practice of walking meditation, changama, sitting meditation. We will purify our minds of obstructive states, basically the hindrances. In the first watch of the night while walking back and forth or sitting, doing the walking meditation or sitting meditation, we'll purify our minds of obstructive states. In the middle watch of the night, we will lie down on the right side in the lion's pose, which is the left foot on top of the right foot, and just the head being supported by your arm with a little pillow underneath the hand. With one foot overlapping the other, mindful and fully aware, after noting in our minds the time of rising. And after rising in the third watch of the night, while walking back and forth sitting, we'll purify minds of obstructive states. Now, I know that looking at the commentaries and other things, there's no real definition of what the first, second, and third watch of the night is. It's not the case that you split the time from sunset to dawn into three equal parts. And I always thought that was the case. But then, you know, sometimes, goodness me, that nighttime can be very short if you're in the Northern Hemisphere. What it really means is just the first watch of the night, whether it's 1 hour, 2 hours, or 3 hours, or whatever, and the last watch of the night is whenever you get up until dawn. It was actually saying you don't go to bed at sunset, you don't get up at dawn. It's, you know, the time after it gets dark when you meditate, there's time before it gets light when you're up and you're meditating. And it's just whatever is necessary for you. Personally, I did try just to sleep 4 hours a night for many years, and just it wrecked my meditation. It was not a good thing. And only later I realized that you needed to rest as much as the body needed without overindulging. Similar to eating. You know, you had that same sort of reflection. I will eat to end old feelings of hunger and not give rise to new feelings of overeating. The same with sleeping. I will sleep so I can get rid of the old feelings of tiredness and not get rise new feelings of either tiredness because I haven't slept enough, or actually it's like lethargy for sleeping too much. That's what I understand as wakefulness. Now, monks, nuns, you may think, we are possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing, bodily, verbal, mental conduct and livelihood have been purified. We guard the door of our sense factors, we are moderate eating and devoted to wakefulness. That much is enough. And you may rest content with that much. Monks, I inform you, I declare to you, you who seek the recluse's status, if you think you deserve to be called monk, nun, samana, or whatever, don't fall short of the goal of being a samana while there is still more to be done. Now, I'm going to go back to that because there's something which I will mention in the wakefulness, which also comes in the mindfulness and full awareness. What more is to be done? Monks, you should train thus. We will be possessed of mindfulness and full awareness. We will act in full awareness when going forward and returning. We will act in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away, when flexing, extending our limbs, when wearing our robes and carrying our outer bowl and robe, when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting, when defecating and urinating, when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent. Now, monks, you may think thus, we are possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing, our bodily conduct, verbal conduct, mental conduct, and livelihood have been purified, we guard the doors of our senses, we are moderate in eating, devoted to wakefulness, and we are possessed of mindfulness and full awareness. That much is enough, that much has been done, the goal of recluseship has been reached, There is nothing more for us to do, and you may rest content with that much. Monks, nuns, I inform you, I declare to you, you who seek the recluse status don't fall short of the goal of recluseship while there's still more to be done. Now, just those last two paragraphs. In the wakefulness one, having lain down on the right side and lying posed with one foot overlapping the other, mindful and fully aware, after noting in our mind the time for rising. So it's mindful and fully aware actually as you are going to sleep, and you note the time for arising. In the times before alarm clocks, you didn't need alarm clocks. You would just say, I would get up in 4 hours or 5 hours or 6 hours. As I've taught on many retreats, that actually works. You go to bed tonight, you don't need to set your alarm clock. You say, I'll get up at 5 in the morning, and you get up 1 or 2 minutes either side of 5, as long as you make a very clear resolution to your mind. The mind remembers it's got its own clock, and you wake up at that time. And when it says, mindful and fully aware, what is the difference between mindfulness and awareness? Because in English, they are actually synonyms. Awareness is being mindful. Mindfulness being aware. So what is the difference? And the difference is this, that it fully awareness is not a very good translation. Pali, it's sati, is mindful. Sampajanya is what they translate here as fully aware. That word, sampajanya, literally means with wisdom. Pajanya is the extended form of panya. Panya, which many of you, even though you may not know Pali, you've heard about panya before, wisdom. Sometimes in Sanskrit it's prajna, as in the Prajna Paramita Sutra, the wisdom. So what this really is, about time it should be translated properly. It means with mindfulness and wisdom. Full awareness misses the point, wisdom. And that wisdom part means, as you should know by now, it's mindful and wise. You know how long you need to sleep. You're wise about sleeping. That's why I was stupid about sleeping, not sleeping enough. Some people are stupid about sleeping, they sleep too much, which means their body never feels right for meditating. So it's mindfulness and wisdom. In fact, many times, because the teachers in Thailand would follow commentaries, and even the commentaries got this right in this one, they never used to call it sati sampajana. They always called it sati panya, which was accurate. So mindfulness with wisdom, mindfulness with wisdom, mindfulness with wisdom. And now you can understand the two of them together are powerful. It's not just repeating mindfulness and full awareness. Full awareness is mindfulness. Mindfulness is full awareness. What's the difference there? No, it means mindfulness and wisdom. And that gives this other piece of information to what we're doing here. And that paragraph 11, the mindfulness and wisdom, what more is to be done? You should train us. We will be possessed of mindfulness and wisdom when going forward, returning, looking ahead, looking away. In other words, we're not just doing this mindful, but also we're wise about this. Is this, should I be looking left? Should I be looking right? Should I be going ahead? Is this the smart thing to do? So it means that we're not just aware, we're also wise. An example, you may be crossing the street with full awareness and mindful and get hit by the truck because you're not smart enough to know there's a truck coming. You're just paying attention to the rise and fall of your legs. It's a stupid thing, but you can understand what I mean. Now, wisdom has to be there with what you're doing. And now it makes a lot of sense. When looking ahead, looking away, flexing, extending our limbs, full awareness and wisdom, when wearing our robes, carrying a robe and bowl, eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting, it's awareness, but we also are wise. We know what we're doing this for. What's the purpose of tasting and eating? When defecating and urinating, we're wise not to strain ourselves, not to sort of spend too long on there because you're reading a newspaper. That's not mindfulness of what you're doing. When walking, standing, sitting, and now falling asleep, waking up. In Nepali, the words do not mean falling asleep and waking up, and this is one of the dangers people have in translating. The word falling asleep is called nidang okamati. Okamana is the present participle. The word here is sute, S-U-T-T-E, which literally means within sleep. Not falling asleep, not waking up, means in the middle of your sleep state. And waking up, it does not mean waking up. The word is being awake, jagariye. So what actually has been done here by Jnanaponika, and Bhikkhu Bodhi has followed him, the word, he knows what the word means. It means in sleep, it means while awake, but how can you be mindful and wise in sleep? It's impossible. You're unconscious when you're in sleep. At least your consciousness is in such a low level when you're dreaming that it's basically sort of no mindfulness there at all. And because a person understood mindfulness and wisdom sort of has to be sort of there in that moment, it means that they mistranslated this to fit in to the title of the section rather than looking at the actual words and realizing there's something going on here, something we don't really understand. It doesn't make sense. Why? And obviously it's very clear. You're mindful as you're going to sleep. You're wise as to the purpose of sleep as you go in there. And then you are no mindfulness, no wisdom while you're in sleep. But it's a mindfulness and wisdom with regard to sleeping, with regard to waking up, with regard to carrying your bowl or wearing your robes. Not actually within that state, which is impossible. You cannot be mindful while you're fully asleep. If you're fully asleep, you're not mindful. If you're mindful, you're not asleep. But if any of you ever get to translating, never actually look at that word and think, that can't make sense, and bend its meaning beyond what is allowed just to fit into the context. There must be something you haven't seen yet. Another example of that is, that famous sutta number one, where at the end of, this is in the Majjhima Nikaya, number one in this book, where at the end of the sutta, it's said in the Pali, and the monks were not delighted at what the Buddha said. And the first translator of that thought, that must be an error. If the Buddha said it, the monks were always delighted. So she actually changed the translation to fit her ideas without really checking that it was the one case where the Buddha gave this teaching which none of the monks understood. They couldn't understand it at all. And that's why they weren't delighted. And a few days later he gave them another sutta which put all the pieces together and they understood it. They all became enlightened. So if she'd known the other sutta, she'd realize, yes, what it actually said there was right, you just didn't fully understand it. So sometimes, if there's something here that said, that doesn't make sense, that doesn't mean, that can't be right, don't think the text is wrong. Sometimes it's you haven't seen it yet. And that's actually exactly what happened here. Okay, any questions? Yes, Dania? Well, you're asking if it's best just to wake up when you wake up, what's the point of noting the time of arising and saying you're going to get up at this particular time? Sometimes the monks had to go on alms round, so they had to get up in time for alms round. Sometimes you have to get up to cook the breakfast if you're on the retreat and doing those duties. So out of compassion for others, you note the time and you get up for that time. So sometimes there is a reason, a duty, a responsibility. However, if you have no duties at all, then I agree with you. It's best to actually just to let the body decide when to wake up. But, as I've taught before and Ajahn Chah taught me, that when you do first wake up, don't just think, oh, another 5 minutes. Oh, now that is not mindfulness and wisdom. As soon as you wake up, you jump out of bed. And what do you say? Zippity-doo-dah, another wonderful day to practice meditation. If you do that, you put energy into the very first minute of your day, then you're set for the day. No. says sometimes yes. Okay, number two. Call someone. Okay. The reason you're asking, why did the Buddha say this is for monks and nuns to be called a samana and it's not being applied to the lay people? Because it was a talk specifically to the monks. And because it's a talk specifically to the monks, and especially to the word samana, which was applied to the monks, then he would say this is what you should do. These days, if it's for yourself or any other people here in this audience, if you want to be called a disciple of the Buddha, a Buddhist, then to deserve that appellation, that designation of a Buddhist, this is what you should be doing. And don't just think that, you know, you're keeping five precepts and that's enough. The Buddha would say, laymen, laywomen, I inform you, I declare to you who seek the status of being a disciple of the Buddha, do not fall short of the goal of that designation. Whether you're a monk, a nun, a upasaka, upasaka, your goal is enlightenment. And don't fall short of that. So these are all the stages. If you get any of these stages, you don't praise yourself, you don't disparage others, but you don't just say, this is enough, I don't need to do any more. Go for broke. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Yes? Yeah. Well, no, I mean, if you get up in the middle of the night, it's only 2 hours, then go to the toilet and go back to bed again. Otherwise, you'll get very sick. If you just practice like that, you know, that after 2 hours, you have to get up and go to the toilet and simply do it on a wonderful day, and you don't go to bed again, that might be mindfulness and wakefulness, but that's not wisdom. You'll get sick. Use the alarm, yes, fine, you can use the alarm. But in those days, remember, there was no alarms, and so the monks would use a noting to get up at a certain time. So, you know, you can use alarms, but it's nice practice just to try the, you know, just making the resolution. It's interesting that you can do that. Good. Now we go into the more interesting stuff, and one of the great reasons I wanted to talk about this is... especially when we get into the four jhanas, because it gets another slant on the jhanas. But it does use a word in the jhanas called kaya, which I think Ajahn Bhamali has talked to you about before, which is a difficult word. It's very often mistranslated, and it creates a lot of confusion. But first of all, paragraphs 12 and 13 and 14 about the hindrances. This is a nirvana. Now, this whole sequence is part of the gradual training. You can see we talked about shame and fear of wrongdoing, purifying bodily, mental, so bodily, verbal, mental conduct and livelihood, and doing such things as restraint of the senses, moderation of eating, wakefulness, and mindfulness and wisdom. Now, this is almost like a preparatory. Now we get into the real heavy stuff. I call it heavy stuff because this is the core part. Abandoning the hindrances. These are enemy number one. What more is to be done? Here, monks, nuns, a monk or nun resorts to a secluded resting place. Secluded. In other words, so you're not going to be too bothered. That can be in your home. You don't need to go out into sort of the bush, a million miles away from anywhere, or a monastery, or in a deep cave. As long as you have the feeling of seclusion there, and many of you have little meditation rooms under the stairs or in a cellar or something, a place where, for you, that's a place of seclusion. The forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside, great cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, a heap of straw. On returning from his alms round, as monks get his meal duties all done, he sits down, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect, establishing mindfulness before him. I've mentioned that that has caused a lot of confusion. People say, before me, and because of Westerners, we think we live in our head. Before me is our nose. So you put the mindfulness in your nose. That is wrong. That is a confusion. In Asia, they always think they live in their heart. So mindfulness before them is in here somewhere. But that before you is not a very good translation. The word priority is the translation which works in English. Priority is you put it in front of you. That's why, you know, in the old monasteries, the prior would be the guy in front. Priority means putting something at the top of your list. And that's what it means here. Not a physical before you or in front of you, but a metaphorical giving mindfulness priority. You get that in your head and it makes so much sense. So, establishing mindfulness as a priority. This is just the prerequisites. Mindfulness first. That takes number one. Abandoning covetousness for the world. Great. You abide with a mind free from covetousness. He purifies his mind from covetousness. Abandoning ill will and hatred. You abide with a mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. You purify your mind of ill will and hatred. Abandoning sloth and torpor, you abide free from sloth and torpor, precipitate of light, mindful and wise. You purify your mind from sloth and torpor. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, you abide unagitated with the mind inwardly peaceful. You purify your mind from restlessness and remorse. Abandoning doubt, you abide having gone beyond doubt. Unperplexed about wholesome states, you purify your mind from doubt. Brilliant stuff here, because it adds that little bit extra. Point number one, covetousness for the world. That's the synonym for the first hindrance. It's usually termed karmachanda, covetousness from the world. You may remember, from those of you who studied Satipatthana Sutta, having abandonness, what's it called? grief and covetousness and grief for the world, I think it's usually translated as. The covetousness from the world means its very first hindrance. The grief is used in two suttas as a synonym for the second hindrance, ill will. Here you see covetousness for the world as one of the words meaning the first hindrance. And it gives you an idea what that means. Oh, and not for covetousness, but ill will. What does it mean, abandoning the hindrance of ill will? It means compassionate for the welfare of all living beings, including yourself. You're one of those living beings. So if you've got no compassion towards yourself and others, that is a hindrance to your meditation. Come on, me, I'm stupid. Come on, sit up straight. Come on, stop messing around. Is that compassion? That's a hindrance. And that's why people don't get into deep meditation. Abandoning sloth and torpor, you abide free from sloth and torpor, percipient of light. And that's that's called aloka, the brightness of the mind. It doesn't mean the nimitta yet. Obviously, if you do get the nimitta, then all sloth and torpor disappears. But it means just the mind, the metaphorical. You know, you feel light, but your mind is bright. So that is, again, a word we use in English. The bright mind or the dull mind is the dark mind. So this is using the metaphor of the brightness of the mind. And you understand what sloth and torpor is. If you understand that mind is dull, dark, dim, or it's bright. And restlessness and remorse. It's great that for many decades, they use restlessness and worry, but the word is actually remorse. What is remorse? It means you keep thinking of all the bad things you've done or something bad you have done. That is a hindrance which is overcome through letting go, through forgiveness. And when you abandon this restlessness and are worried about the bad things you've done, you abide unagitated with a mind inwardly peaceful. You understand, because many of you experience an inwardly peaceful mind. And abandoning doubt, sometimes people ask, what do you mean by doubt? Here gives a good example. You've gone beyond doubt, you're unperplexed about wholesome states. What is the good state? In particular, what I've been teaching for the last 2 or 3 years. You understand that making peace with things, being kind, being gentle, is a wholesome state of mind. The wholesomeness doesn't lie in the object you're aware of. That's all karma. It's how you are dealing with that state. That's the wholesome, the kusala. So it doesn't matter if you're seeing a demon. It's what you are doing with that demon you're seeing, whether you're making peace, being kind, being gentle. Or if you've got a beautiful nimitta, are you making peace, being kind, being gentle? If you are making peace, being kind, being gentle, that is a wholesome state of mind. Does not matter what you are experiencing. How you are experiencing it is what defines it as wholesome, as kusala. That gets rid of all your doubts. The doubt in meditation is, what should I be doing? Or usually, what should I be doing next? The answer? Just making peace, just being kind, just being gentle. Have no doubt about that. That works. You've overcome the hindrances. Now we get some great similes from the Buddha. This is why this is a very rich sutta, which is why, please, not too many questions, because there's just too much interesting stuff in this. Suppose a person were to take a loan and undertake a business, and his business were to succeed so that he could repay all the money of the old loan, and there would remain enough extra to maintain a wife. Then, considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. Now, this is actually referring to the first hindrance. The first hindrance of sensory desire is compared to taking out a loan. You're actually borrowing happiness when you get into sensory pleasures. In other words, seeing a movie on TV, wow, this is really, really good. You're borrowing happiness. It's artificial. It's not coming from within. It's supplied from without, which means at the end of the movie, you have to pay it back. You're dull. You're a little bit negative because you've borrowed that happiness. It wasn't yours. And like most loans, you have to pay them back with interest. So it's this interesting thing. So I shouldn't use the word interesting, but fascinating, that if you don't take out a loan, you're usually actually much wealthier. So if you don't get into the sensory pleasures, you have more happiness. So getting into those five sense happiness is borrowing happiness. And you have to pay it back with interest afterwards. The next simile, suppose a man were afflicted, suffering and gravely ill, and his food would not agree with him, and his body had no strength, but later he would recover from that affliction, his food would agree with him, and his body would gain strength, and considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. That is the simile for ill will. It's an affliction. You're suffering and gravely ill, and when you're in a bad mood, even your food doesn't agree with you. But when that hindrance is overcome, just as I didn't mention, when the hindrance, you paid off your debts and you got money left over, then you're glad and full of joy. It means when you've got none of that first hindrance gone. And the debts of that means that at first when you meditate, you have to pay off a few debts of sensory indulgence. But when they're all paid off, then you have this beautiful full of joy. You've just got your own happiness, not the memories or looking for happiness in the memories and fantasies of the five senses. And it's the same when ill will has disappeared. You've let go of that ill will. Ah, your body feels so peaceful and happy. It's like and your food tastes nice. In other words, you've got your strength back. And then you'll be glad and full of joy. Imprisoned. That's a simile of sloth and torpor. For those of you, whenever you sort of really feel sloth or tired and dull, it is like a prison. You just can't think, you can't do anything. It's like you are in a jail. And that's a simile for sloth and torpor, being in a prison cell. Suppose a person was in prison, in a prison house, but later would be released from prison, safe and secure, with no loss to his property. Then on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. That's a joy when the hindrance of sloth and torpor and dullness. I think many of you are great experts on sloth and torpor. So you can understand that it does feel like a prison. You can't do anything. Or suppose a man were a slave. I love this simile. This is one, number one. Or suppose a man were a slave, not self-dependent, but dependent on others, unable to go where you want. But later on, you'd be released from slavery, independent of others, a free person, able to go where you want. On considering this, you'd be glad and full of joy. That is restlessness and remorse. You've got no freedom. You've always been told what to do. Come on, get up. Come on, think about this. Come up, go and read a book. Come on, go to bed. Come on, pick up the phone. Come on, do this. Come on, meditate. Come on, watch your breath. Come on, come on. That restlessness which is in the mind, which you usually associate with the will. That's like the prison guard, like the torturer, like the marine in Guantanamo Bay, never allowing you one moment of peace. The restlessness of the mind. And that's a simile. It's like being a slave, never being free from this constant restlessness, always never allowing you to stay still and to just to sit down and rest for a moment, constantly pushing you, get up, sit down, go for a walk, do this, do that. You are a slave to the restlessness. And you get rid of that restlessness in meditation, you do feel free. And lastly, doubt. Suppose a person with wealth and property would enter a road across a desert, but later on he would cross over the desert, safe and secure, with no loss to the property. Then on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. That's a simile for the hindrance of doubt. You're in a desert. You don't know which way. You've got no GPS. You haven't got a clue which way is the way out. And sometimes people in the desert do go round and round and round in circles. I can't resist. You know, it's my character. I should be restrained, but I ain't to this today. About the guy in the desert who was lost for many, many days. He was crawling on his hands and knees. He was hallucinating. And so when he saw a dog and sled come towards him with an Eskimo in furs, he said, I must be dreaming. An Eskimo in the desert. And so they came right up to him. And when he could feel the dog's breath on him and the dog licking him, he realized this wasn't a hallucination. It wasn't a mirage. It was real. Oh, thank you so much. I've been lost in this desert for days. And the Eskimo said, you think you've lost. I do apologize. Anyway, that's the simile of being lost in the desert. That's like having doubt, not knowing where you are, what you should be doing. And that happens to you in meditation. How many times in your meditation, what am I supposed to be doing next? You are in a desert, in an unknown territory. And someone comes along and say, make peace, be kind, be gentle. Ah, I know what I'm supposed to do. I know the direction I'm supposed to go. So the hindrance of doubt is overcome. So, two monks. When these five hindrances are unabandoned in themselves, you see them respectively as the debt, sensory desire, a disease, ill will, a prison house, sloth and torpor, slavery, restlessness and remorse, and a road across a desert, doubt. But when these five hindrances have been abandoned in you, you see themselves as free from debt. Your mortgage is paid off. You're healthy, you're released from prison, you're free from slavery, and you're in a land of safety. And in each one of those, you would be glad and full of joy. Remember, the gladness and full of joy is a sign you are practicing on the path. It's meant to happen, it's supposed to happen. When it does happen, don't think that something must have gone wrong. I'm happy. It's meant to happen. So that's what happens when the five hindrances overcome. It gives a beautiful feeling of happiness and joy. Pause. Any questions?
Yes, back to the covetousness of the world. Do we associate that, for instance, you know, the tragedy that's been going on in Burma?
Japan?
Japan,
Yeah.
So that's what they mean by this sort of covetousness for the world. One is God and the other myself. I didn't feel I had that.
Yeah, you are the covetous for the world here. You're saying that when people talk to you about the recent tragedies in Japan, earthquake, tsunami, nuclear problems, that, yeah, you felt sad, but you let it go pretty quickly, and other people are still concerned about it. And you're asking, is that the difference between covetous for the world and not covetous for the world? That is a very refined lack of covetous for the world. The sense of, yeah, you've done what you can be done, but this is part of the world, it's part of the five sense world, these things will happen, it's par for the course, you can't do too much about it except try and avoid it if possible, but you have to let it go because you worrying about it doesn't help anybody. So, you know, you have a wise attitude, it's part of covetousness for the world, and it's also part of not being restless. You know, one of the things which people worry about that because they've got to worry about something. And they just, you know, the restlessness and remorse will always take any object, whichever object is there. If it's not the earthquake in Japan, it's, you know, what's happening in the footy this afternoon, or what's happening in the stock market, or what's happening somewhere in the current edition, the current episode of Neighbours. People always want to worry about something. So that is, again, part of restlessness and remorse, and also it is part of the hindrance of sensory desire, covetousness for the world. Okay, now we get to some interesting stuff about the four jhanas. Always you do these preliminary practices, five hindrances gone, jhanas come. As Ajahn Bhumani pointed out to me a long time ago, and it was a very good insight, the whole practice of the meditator is overcome these five hindrances to get the jhanas. That's a pivot point in your practice. The five hindrances are stopping the jhanas. Overcome them, way to jhanas is open to you. So you get those jhanas. Overcome hindrances, get jhanas, get enlightened. That's the path. The four jhanas, having abandoned these five hindrances, you have to abandon them first of all, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded, I'm going to do my changed translation here, as many of you know, secluded from not sensual pleasures, but the five senses. Again, Bhikkhu Ajahn Bhumani has, I think, written a paper on this. The word karma in this plural form always means the five senses, not sensory pleasure. So, having abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from the five senses. In other words, in jhana, you can't see, hear, smell, taste, or touch. Secluded from unwholesome states, which are the five hindrances, you enter upon and abide in the first jhana, which is accompanied by the movement of the mind onto the object and holding onto the object. It's no thinking is possible within the jhana. Vitaka vichara, which are the Pali words here, are even in the Chinese agamas translated differently in the context of the jhanas. They mean something different in one context than the other context. The commentaries agree with me, and meditators who know what they're talking about also. Which is accompanied, okay, and this is great translation here, with the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. It's a pleasure, the rapture and pleasure, that is the object in the jhanas, you're blissed out, huge bliss, the rapture and pleasure, which is caused by the seclusion from what? The seclusion from the five senses and the hindrances. You're free. That's what it means. If it was just secluded from sensual pleasures, then that is actually the first hindrance. It would be sort of a repetition there. They've already got five hindrances have gone. So it doesn't mean just the five hindrances are gone. It means the awareness of the body is gone too. You can't hear, you can't see, you can't feel anything in the body, smell or taste. Oh, what freedom. Freedom from a burden. That is the pleasure. That is the bliss of the first jhana. That's its taste. Now, this is the interesting one which confuses people. He makes that rapture and pleasure born of seclusion, which is the main object, drench, deep, fill, and pervade this body so there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Just as this was in the old times in India when they used bath powder to bathe, you didn't have soap or shower cream. A skilled bathman or a bathman's apprentice would heap bath powder in a metal basin and sprinkle it gradually with water. He would knead it until the moisture wets his ball of bath powder, soaks it and pervades it inside and out, yet the ball itself does not ooze. So too a monk makes a rapture and pleasure born of seclusion, drench, deep, fill and pervade the body so there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Now, I just told you that by the time you get into jhana, you cannot have any experience or feeling of your physical body. And the problem here comes from the word kaya, body. What does a body mean? It can mean your physical body, but even in English we use the word body to mean a body of soldiers, or in law, a body of evidence. Even in Pali, a body means any accumulation of things formed into a set of things. And in Pali, we also have a very common word called namakaya. We have rupakaya and namakaya. And namakaya means the body of mental phenomena. And the kaya means anything here, it means the mental phenomena, the experience of the jhana, the bliss and the rapture just pervade every part of that experience. Not the body, but of the mental experience of the jhana. Just pure piti sukha. But the simile here of the ball not oozing means that joy, that pleasure, that energy is contained in the mind. It doesn't ooze back into the body again. And I've known many meditators, just one even recently, who was just telling me that when he was meditating, I think it was actually in Melbourne when I was there, they were getting some nice meditation, but I know it was actually in Bodhinyana, getting some nice meditation, but the body was shaking and they're getting all this energy in the body. And I've been using for quite a few years now a simile. You've got like what we call a leaky bucket. The energy is not staying in the mind. It's dripping out. It's oozing back into the body. And that's creating all this shaking, this moving up and about, and these energies, which are quite disturbing to a person. Yeah, they might feel nice, but they're stopping you getting into some much, much better states. So when you really get into those deep meditations of first jhana, you're totally cut off from the body, which means that energy stays in that sixth sense of the mind. It stays there, builds up until just that experience is just full of bliss, full of piti sukha. There's no part of that experience which doesn't have the piti sukha, and it doesn't ooze out into the body. That's the meaning of that simile. Don't think that the kaya here means a physical body. Even in English, we don't use the body always to mean the physical body. And that becomes very clear when we get to the simile of the fourth jhana, which is coming soon. Again, when we finish the jhanas, I'll ask for any questions. Second jhana. Again, monks, nuns, lay people, with the stilling of this movement of the mind onto the object and holding onto the object, a monk, nun, lay person enters upon abides in the second jhana, which has self-confidence. There's no self, it's internal confidence and singleness of mind without any movement of the mind called vitakka vichara. This time with a rapture and pleasure born of samadhi, of stillness. Again, concentration doesn't really sort of match the meaning of that word. Stillness does. This is because that movement of the mind onto the object and holding onto the object was a movement. That has gone. Now there is perfect stillness. Nothing is moving. That is the meaning of, say, concentration here, but it's samadhi, stillness. The self-confidence, that is the fact that you have, or the mind has such confidence, it does not need to hold on to anything. It is a confidence which gives rise to the full letting go, which is a cause of the stillness. As mentioned many times, as you all know by now, fear creates control, which causes a movement. that confidence is the cause of letting go, which causes stillness. So it's that confidence, internal confidence, which is the cause of that final bit of letting go. You don't need to hold on to anything anymore. You're confident to totally let go. Just like a baby in his mother's arms or her mother's arms. He's so confident that I've been in these shopping centres, you know, going to the travel agent or going to get some lunch in the food court. And I've seen mothers carrying their babies and the baby is fast asleep. And there's so many people in that shopping centre. If anyone was carrying me, I'd be paranoid you might drop me or someone might hit me and I'd fall on the ground. Actually, with my weight, you probably would drop me. But babies have got such confidence in their mothers, they go fast asleep with no fear at all. They're just such confidence, their mother is not going to drop them. Now, that's the type of confidence you get in these deep meditations. You can let go so totally because you're confident, and then you get into the second jhana. And he makes the rapture and pleasure born of that stillness, no more movement, drenched deep, fill and pervade this body, so there's no part of your whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of stillness. And this is a beautiful simile. Just as though there were a spring-fed lake, instead of whose waters welled up from below, that's what it means. Just as though we were a spring-fed lake, and it had no inflow from east, west, north, and south, and would not be replenished from time to time by showers of rain. So no water is coming out, coming into that lake from outside. It's always coming from inside. Then that cool fount of water welling up in the lake would make the cool water drench deep, fill, and pervade the whole lake. So there'd be no part of the whole lake unpervaded by the cool water. So too a monk makes a rapture and pleasure born of stillness, drenched deep, full and pervade this mental body of experience. So there's no part of this whole mental body of experience unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of stillness. Remember, you're so still now, there's nothing coming in from outside. No sort of sight, sound, smells, taste or touch. A totally self-contained mind with just that coolness. Beautiful word, like a cool. There's nothing moving there. You're still. It's really cool. Still, cool pleasure, drenching that experience. So, incredible, beautiful metaphor of some things which are so hard to describe, and the Buddha sort of nails it. And again, it's not the physical body. It's a long time gone. Again, monks, with a fading away as well of rapture, a part of this pleasure disappears. A monk, nun, layperson abides in equanimity and mindful and wise, not fully aware, still feeling the pleasure with this experience, so the pleasure is still there, you enter upon an abide in the third jhana, on account of which noble ones announce you have a pleasant abiding who has equanimity and is mindful. And he makes that pleasure, divested of rapture, a drench deep, fill and pervade the whole experience. So there's no part of the whole experience unpervaded by the pleasure divested of rapture. And again, this is where you can get a deeper understanding of what rapture, pleasure, what bliss is. The bliss of the second jhana is incredible. Now part of that disappears and what's left is much, much more refined. It's a higher pleasure. Just now the simile, just as in a pond of blue or red or white lotuses. Some lotuses that are born and grow in the water thrive immersed in the water without rising out of it. And cool water drenches, steeps, fills and pervades them to their tips and their roots. So there's no part of all these lotuses unpervaded by cool water. So too a monk makes his pleasure divested of rapture, drenched deep, fill and pervade his whole body. So there's no part of his whole body of experience unpervaded by the pleasure divested of rapture. So again, that bliss of the third jhana, cooling, pervading the whole experience. Now, the last jhana, the fourth jhana here, makes it very clear that this interpretation of kaya is valid. It cannot mean the body, because look at this. Again, monks, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, this is the happiness and joy of the body, and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, which is a mental happiness and unhappiness. A monk enters upon and abides, a monk, nun, layperson, enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. These are highly mindful states. When people say, oh, these jhanas, you don't really know what's going on. It's a trance, it's a dullness. This is the purity of mindfulness. This is when your awareness reaches its peak. You cannot be more mindful. You sit pervading this body with a pure, bright mind. So there's no part of this whole body of experience unpervaded by the pure, bright mind. Just as though a man were sitting covered from the head down with a white cloth, so there'd be no part of his whole body unpervaded by the white cloth. So a monk sits pervading this mental body with a pure, bright mind. So there's no part of the whole body unpervaded by the pure, bright mind. I don't think any meditator would ever contest that in a fourth jhana you're still aware of your body. That is totally sort of nonsense. The body here, kaya, cannot mean the physical body. It means the mental body of the experience. Pause. Any questions? I think you got your hand up first. Yes. You're asking, is the third jhana the highest pleasure? At the time, it experiences as pleasure, but in the fourth jhana, when you get beyond that pleasure, there's another pleasure. So every one of these, you're redefining, you know, through your experience, the meaning of happiness. Yeah, I just say if a person has a self view, in other words, they think that there is some essence which exists somewhere, can they hold the third jhana? You'll find that if there is some sort of self view, it gets harder to attain the jhanas. Remember that the way into the jhanas is through a huge amount of letting go. In particular, letting go of control, letting go of doing, which is letting go of restlessness, letting go of wanting and ill will, which is another thing the doer is very good at. And whenever there is a self, this is a saying of the Buddha, there's always things which belong to a self. There's always ownership and attachment. So it really does mean that whenever there is an idea of a self, there'll be ownership, attachment, and it's hard to let go. It's not impossible to let go. People can get into third or fourth jhanas, but it's much, much harder. Yes?
My point is, I'm not going to be that because I know nothing. Yeah. The plot in the water. But I'm trying to say is that if you are really, really so happy person, so much happiness in you as a jhanas person, suppose you flow into the jhana.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the thing is that yes. Okay. Yeah, I understand what you mean. You're saying if you believe it. Yeah. If a person sort of holds on to like a God idea or an original mind idea, you're saying that they cannot sort of abide in those first jhanas with such an idea. The point is that as you get into those jhanas, all that thinking and all those ideas, they're left behind, they're left at the door as you go in. So as you go in, you know, you don't have any concept of an original mind or of a God or anything. that conceptual world is totally let go before you enter. But you stay there as long as, however, when you come out again, you know, many of those ideas will be challenged. Challenged, not necessarily overturned, but challenged. So sometimes people's, you know, delusion or their arrogance is so strong that they will get into those jhanas, they'll come out afterwards, and they'll still hold on to those old views. But they will be weakened. I agree with you that if you hold on to such views as original mind or was it unmanifest consciousness, you're shortchanging the teachings, and also you're not sort of reflecting the teachings in the suttas by the Buddha. So anyway, I have to move on now. Dania. Very good. You ask. No, one at a time. You can ask. Yeah. Okay. It's just the relationship between the five hindrances and the jhanas is almost like an either or. Either you got the five hindrances or you got the jhanas. Because once the five hindrances are overcome, abandoned fully, and basically the doors to jhana are wide open. There's nothing obstructing you. That's why they're called hindrances. Nivarana means obstructions. The opposite of that is vivarana, means it's open. So it's like you have an open road and the jhanas are just, they're just there for you. There's no obstacle, no hindrance, there's no problem, there's no trouble. So, you know, if the jhanas were right in front of you and there's no obstacle, of course you'd go into them. There's no reason why not to. It would be natural. You've got all this bliss and there's nothing stopping you. You know, if I had $1 million here and no one owned it, of course you would take it. So this is much better than $1 million. It's just bliss and incredible, powerful spiritual experiences. The five hindrances are the obstacles to the jhanas. When they're overcome, jhanas are natural, easy, obvious. That's why for, you know, arahats especially, they've got no hindrances left at all. So jhanas are just, okay, I'm going jhana today. And just enter, easy. So the bliss of the previous sections, you know, when you've overcome, so you've got sense restraints and you've got moderation in eating and mindfulness and wisdom with whatever you're doing, that just gives you what's called the anavijja sukha, the blameless happiness, and the abhayasekha sukha from the sense restraint. These are all happinesses and joys which are part of it. They strengthen and empower the mind. The joy and happiness of the mind is this energy. And it empowers the mind to really overcome the hindrances. Because, you know, when you're really happy, just, you know, being right here, right now, who wants anything? You're really happy. It's very hard to get angry at people when you're having a good time. And it's also the dullness, sloth and torpor. When you're happy, you've got energy. You don't get sloth and torpor. And restlessness and remorse. What is restlessness anyway? If it's seeking happiness over here, happiness over there, fulfillment here, wanting this. But when you're happy right here, there's no restlessness. As mentioned before, discontent is the cause of restlessness. And the doubt, that's not directly overcome by joy and happiness, but it certainly is weakened and it really opens the mind up, energizes it, you can actually see the way. So yes, the joy and happiness does help enormously the mind overcome the five hindrances to open the way to jhanas.
Five hindrances are abandoned, joy arises, and
Yeah. Okay. Once you have the joy, I'm just summarizing your question, once you have the joy which comes up from the abandonment of the five hindrances, the link is, you've heard me say this many times before, Dania, you probably even recognize the Pali phrase, Sukhino Chittang Samadhi Yati. The happy mind is easy to become still. And remember, you don't take up the happiness and joy. The happiness and joy is a cause for stillness. And it's the stillness which takes you into jhana. You don't do jhana. You don't take up objects. You don't drive your car into jhanas. You stop all the driving. So once that happiness is there, the five hindrances have gone. You don't do jhanas. Jhanas do you. Sort of. They do you in. Okay, yes. How many meditators? Some do, not all. Meditators have got jhanas on 9-day retreats. Are you coming on my retreat, sir? Find out. Because it is difficult for a layperson. But you've been living in Bodhinyana Monastery for a while. So, you should have a really strong foundation there. And one of the difficulties is not having decent instructions. I'm trying to give you the very, very best instructions. Letting go, making peace, being kind, being gentle, being compassionate, sort of relaxing, as I was talking about in Saturday afternoon. Those are the sort of the keys. Doing it, trying it. Right, this is it. 9-day retreat, come all the way from Germany. I'm going to get jhana. Right, no messing around. 4 hours sleep. I'm not going to even eat. Now, those people, you've seen them so many times, absolute idiots. And they never get anywhere. Don't be a control freak. This is all about letting go, disappearing, vanishing. It's not about you anymore. It's about you getting out of the way. So it's a great sutta here. Five hindrances, they're the enemies. So don't try and strive to watch the breath. See what needs to be done to abandon the hindrances. Do the hindrances lie in the breath? Do the hindrances lie in the nimitta or lie in the body when you're watching the body? No, the hindrances are the way you watch the body, the way you watch the breath. It's what's between you and the mental object. That's why making peace, being kind, being gentle is a powerful way of overcoming hindrances. Just making peace. There's no covetousness there anymore. There's no restlessness. Being kind. No ill will. And just as I say, making peace, the sloth and torpor vanish pretty quickly. Making peace, being kind, being gentle. And you understand that is the way. No more doubt. Hindrances get knocked on the head. It does not matter what you're experiencing. How you're experiencing it is the key. Okay. And there's any other questions over there? No, good. Okay. The three true knowledges now is sort of, that was the meaty part, hindrances and jhanas. Now this is just well known, but it gives some other brilliant metaphors. The three knowledges, I like to call them the three insights, just to stir people up. Because, these are insights. This is actually the insights which give rise to enlightenment. This is what you see, the vision, the insight, the understanding. So when their mind is still, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, after the jhana, you emerge from the jhanas, You direct it to knowledge of the recollection of your past lives. You recollect your manifold past lives, one birth, two births, many births. Thus, with their aspects and particulars, you recollect your past lives. Now, this is a simile here. Just as a man might go from his own village to another village, and then back again to his own village, he might think, I went from my own village to that village, and there I stood in such a way, sat in such a way, spoke in such a way, kept silent in such a way, and that from that village I went to that other village. And there I stood in such a way, sat in such a way, spoke in such a way, kept silent in such a way, and from that village I came again to my own village. So too, a monk recollects their manifold past lives. With their aspects and particulars, you recollect your manifold past lives. And that's a rare place when the Buddha gives a simile of what he means by this. So just like, you know, you come to Dhammaloka. And this evening, you know, you go back home and you remember when I was in Dhammaloka, I sat and listened to the talk, you know, I asked the questions, I went to the toilet, you know, I was silent. You remember all these things. In just the same way, you remember than your previous life. This is what I did, this is where I was, this is how I behaved. This is what the recollection of the past lives are like. Very clear and beautiful simile. The second insight. When the still mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and tame to imperturbability, you direct it to knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings according to their karma. This is the way we understand the law of karma. Thus, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, you see beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, and they understand how beings pass on according to their karma, that's actions. Just as though there were two houses with doors, and a man with good sight standing there between them saw people entering the houses and coming out and passing to and fro. So too with the divine eye which is purified and surpasses a human, a meditator sees beings passing away and reappearing, and he understands how beings pass on according to their actions. Like two houses, you're in between, you see them coming out of one house, going to another house, from that house to another house. You understand why they go from one house to another, why they go to the beauty house, why they go to the ugly house, why they go to the, you know, the lower realm house, the higher realm house. You see just how they pass from one life to another. I understand why that happens. I understand the law of karma. The second great insight. In another sutta, he says these are the three breakings out of a chicken from its egg. The first crack in the egg is understanding past lives. The second crack in the egg is understanding the law of karma. And the third crack is what's coming next, where the chick comes out of its egg. When the still mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, they're directed to knowledge of the destructions of the outflowings, the taints, the asavas. Here it's their taints. I prefer outflowings. That's a pretty accurate meaning. You understand as it really is. This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to cessation of suffering, the Four Noble Truths. You understand it fully, what suffering is, what dukkha is, such as the senses are all suffering, even the best form of them. You understand sort of what causes that suffering, craving, wanting, even wanting good things is suffering. You understand actually there is an end of that suffering, the four ways of letting go, throwing things away, freedom, in other words, happy to be here. Teflon mind. What's the other one? Mutti analia? That's right, giving. That's right. Giving up, giving away. And there's the four ways of letting go. And the path itself, the Eightfold Path, which is what we just talked about here. Just the moralities of right speech, right action, right livelihood, and the right views which come. The right intentions, making peace, being kind, being gentle, giving rise to right effort, mindfulness, and right stillness, the Eightfold Path. You understand what this actually is? When you know and see thus, the mind is liberated from the outflowing of sensual desire. You don't want anything anymore. From the outflowing caused by being. As to be is to do, said Sartre. No, said Anderson. Yeah, that was actually, Sartre said that, to be is to do. This is actually where, whenever you have an idea of being someone or existing, you have to do something, you have to act, you have to participate. Otherwise, you don't exist anymore. So it's an outflowing caused by the illusion that you are. And last one is the outflowing of delusion, thinking someone in here anyway. When it is liberated, not when you are liberated, not when the monk is liberated, there's no he anymore. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge, it is liberated. You can't be enlightened without knowing it. There comes a knowledge, it is liberated. You understand, birth is destroyed. No more rebirth. Holy life has been lived. What had been done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. And now another beautiful simile. Just as if there were a lake in a mountain recess, clear, limpid, and undisturbed, so that a man with good sight standing on the bank could see shells, gravel, and pebbles, and also shoals of fish swimming about resting, he may think, ah, there is this lake, clear, limpid, and undisturbed, and there are these shells, gravels, and pebbles on the bottom, and also these shoals of fish swimming about and resting. So a monk understands it actually is, this is suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, the way leading to the end of the suffering. He understands birth is destroyed, the whole life has been lived. What had to be done has been done, there is no more coming to any state of being. The simile of like the clear, limpid pool. You can see clearly. There's no sort of murky delusion anymore. You see everything from the top to the bottom, right to the shells and the gravel and the pebbles at the bottom, and all the fish swimming in between. The clarity of wisdom. Birth is destroyed, whole life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. No more coming to any state of being. Not to an original mind, Cheng, not to any state of existence. Monks, nuns, lay people. A monk or a nun such as this is called a samana. This is what a recluse means. This is what you're supposed to live up to. A Brahmin, one who has been washed, one who has attained to knowledge, a holy scholar, a noble one, an arahat. Those were all names used at that particular time in India to refer to a saint, a holy one. Sometimes they call them a real recluse, a Brahmin, one who has been washed. It was actually just a metaphor. It sounds weird to us these days because, you know, we wash maybe one, two, three times a day. But one who's been washed was a metaphor of someone who was purified of all delusion, was a saint. He has attained to knowledge, a holy scholar. A holy scholar in those days was not someone who was well versed at the universities, but one who knew from direct experience, a noble one, an arahat. And how is a bhikkhu a recluse, a nun a recluse? They have quieted down evil unwholesome states that defile, bring renewal of being, given trouble, ripen in suffering, lead to future birth, aging and death. That is how a monk or a nun is called a samana. They have quieted down. That word is samatha. They've quelled it. That's the whole meaning of samatha. Is there a problem? It's been dealt with. It does no longer exist. That's why in the Vinaya of the monks, the last seven rules, in the 227 rules for monks, the last seven or 311 for nuns, is it 311? Yeah, for nuns, for bhikkhunis, is the seven adhikarana samatha. Adhikarana means business of the sangha. The seven ways of settling the business of the sangha. So there's something to be done. You do it, it disappears, it's gone. That's the meaning of samatha. Settling the business, calming it down. And the result of having been settled, the business is not on the agenda anymore. It's disappeared. So this is one who has summited evil, unwholesome states. They've gone, finished. And this is evil, unwholesome states that bring renewal of being, give trouble, ripen in suffering, lead to future birth. They're gone, finished. You summited them down. And how is a monk or nun or Brahmin? They have expelled evil, unwholesome states that defile, exactly the same definition. And how is a monk who has been washed? Exactly the same definition. How is one who has attained to knowledge? They have known evil, unwholesome states that defile. How is a monk or holy scholar? They have evil, unwholesome states that defile have been known. How is a bhikkhu, a noble one? The same definition. How is a bhikkhu, an arahat? Evil, unwholesome states that defile. Renewal of being, give trouble, ripening, suffering, lead to future birth, arahat and death are far away from him. That is how a monk is an arahat. That is what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So that particular sutta gives the gradual training, which is why it takes a bit of time. But this particular sutta stands out by giving more similes than anything else about the path. And those similes elucidate the meaning of the gradual path, whether it's hindrances, whether it's jhanas, or whether there's these three insights which occur after the jhanas, such as exactly what it means by understanding past lives, what it means by understanding karma. I love that simile, just seeing people go from one house to another, and why they go from this house and why they go to that house, according to the law of karma, and understanding just the total end of the asavas, the cause of rebirth. So clear, just like looking in a clear pool and seeing everything from the bottom of the pool, the pebbles and the shells, everything which is in between, the fish, right to the surface. Total clear knowledge. So that is the Maha Asapura Sutta. Any questions before we finish off? Yes. Okay, those who haven't asked questions first. Yes, John? Could you repeat that, please? Oh, yes, yeah. Are you saying at that point the meditator sees at the stage where the asavas have been overcome? You see that Four Noble Truths is at the stage where the sense of self has been seen and overcome. Usually they say there's three main ways to become enlightened, seeing suffering, dukkha, seeing anatta, or seeing anicca. But really they're just three aspects of the same thing. In the same way that before it talked about the Four Noble Truths, the asava of being and the ignorance, those particular ones are talking about, you know, the illusion of a self, the delusion I am or I own. And the I own part comes in the Four Noble Truths as craving. And the I am is more like the craving, the sense of being. Basically, when one is seen fully, so are the other twos. Three aspects of one and the same experience. So sometimes the Buddha just focuses on just the anatta part of the experience of enlightenment. Say, you know, to see the outflowing of being, there's no being there. Sometimes it's of the suffering part, you know, seeing the Four Noble Truths, understanding, wow, this is really suffering, this is what causes suffering, so I'm going to let go of the causes and all suffering ends. And the anicca part of it, that sometimes that's there as well, but that is not as strong a focus as dukkha and anatta. So it's certainly the case that when you see the Four Noble Truths, you also see non-self. Well, that's an old sort of question there. Can you become a sotapanna? I mean, attain the fruit of sotapanna without the jhanas. There are some indications in the suttas that might be possible, but that causes a lot of trouble with my experiential knowledge. I truly cannot see a person can become a sotapanna without at least one experience of jhana. I just can't see that. And the simile which I've given before is, you know, the old tadpole and the frog. Tadpole, born in water, lived all its life in water. There's no way it can understand what water is. It's got to get out of water, become a frog. And then it has the chance to actually understand what water is once water has disappeared. In the same way, you can't really understand self or even the body or suffering until some things have disappeared. And it's a job of jhanas. What jhanas actually are, a great description, is a whole heap of what you thought to be real disappeared. You've been living in the water, and now, God, it's gone. Something's missing. And not just small things, things which have defined your very existence, your body, your five senses, your will. These are just no longer there. So the frog has moved out of the lake. And that gives it the opportunity, the possibility of seeing the Dhamma. So yeah, it's true. I think people can get onto the path of being a stream winner without the jhanas. And I think that's where the confusion is in many of the suttas. Because in Pali they make very little distinction between someone on the path of being a stream winner and someone who's attained the fruit of stream winning. The reason is, I saw this in the Vinaya, that in the, I'm going technical now, but please bear with me. In the first Parajika, sorry, in the second Parajika, the third Parajika rule, which is intentionally killing a living being. In the commentaries, they made this very strange claim that if a monk has the intention of killing you, and so I set a trap. I'm going to sort of adapt the commentary story to modern. So before you came in here, I put a bomb under your car. So as soon as you turn the ignition on, your car will blow up. Now, you know, I intend to kill you, so you go into your car and you turn the ignition and you're killed. I committed a parajika. Actually, I had to disrobe when I put that device on your car, not when you killed yourself. Because it was certain that as soon as I put that thing on your car, that you would die. If it's certain, then it's already happened, even though technically it hasn't happened. The similar way of looking at it is maybe some mafia boss or bikie boss has put a price on my head, and someone comes up, Ajahn Brahm, you're dead. So I'm alive, I can speak, I can walk, I'm not dead. But what they're meaning is, your death is certain, therefore you're dead. And that's actually the way which was used in Pali a lot, much more so than English. If it was certain, it's as if it had already happened. So once you were on the path to being a stream winner, your attainment of stream winning was certain. That's why in the Pali they make very little distinction between someone on the path of stream winning and someone who's actually attained to being a stream winner. So, yes, to be on the path, you don't need jhanas. But I say, to actually achieve stream winning, you do need the jhanas. I think the confusion comes between those on the path and those who are certain to achieve the path. Achieve the fruit, sorry. Anyway, that's a whole different point. At the back over there, Chris. A person who, the answer will make the question quite clear. a person who enters the jhanas regularly will have such a strong mind. Again, the door will be open to knowing your past lives and also to knowing the law of karma. So because it's open, there's nothing really stopping you except just the intention to do it, to ask the question. And so that once you have the jhanas, you also need a little bit of instruction, the teachings from other enlightened beings, the words of another, as it says in one of the suttas. And you do need those basic instructions, plus the jhanas, to be able to get these great insights. Someone that has to suggest to you, there are such a thing as past lives, and this is what you should do after jhana. Ask yourself, what's my earliest memory? Investigate the law of karma. And I've already done that for you. So the words are already in your subconscious. So people like that who've heard teachings like what I've said or read the suttas, that's all that's necessary there for after jhanas. The mind will incline to that and discover that. So you do need, very similar to the Tibetan transmission ideas, a teaching from another wise person or from the books, which just gives the mind the directions after jhana, to make use of that jhana, to see these great insights. And when they do happen, like, happening like a train is maybe train hitting you is a bit too violent. More like just, you know, things opening out to you. Wow, yeah, it's actually real, I can do it, and there it is. Okay, yeah, you just, I can't help but feel that. After a deep sit, all those words which I've conditioned into you can't spilling out. Only the ones which are relevant to that state of mind come out. So especially if it's after a jhana, that idea of let's get past lives, that will come up. And that is the cause. Okay, Andreas? What actually happens is, automatically, does it take a long time? If you have good teachings, and if you don't have a good teacher, this is a brilliant teacher. You know, the teachings of the Buddha, you know, which are reasonably well translated. I always change things a bit because they're not the best translation, but they're good enough. They will be the cause. Not you, but, you know, those things get in your head. And after you emerge from a jhana, the mind will know what to do once it's received instructions like this.